You're listening to a podcast of RN's The Music Show. Some of the music here might be faded for copyright reasons. You can listen to the full programme on our website or on your radios Saturday and Sunday mornings at 11. It's also repeated Saturday and Sunday evenings at 9 and Wednesday and Thursday nights at 11. It's time to talk to Steve Van Zandt. As Steve Van Zandt, he is a member of the E Street Band, but he has also been Southside Johnny with the Asbury Jukes. That was his first band. And he's got a new band, well, not a new band, another band, but they're coming to Australia, and that's Little Stephen and the Disciples of Soul. You may know Steve Van Zandt best as an actor if you're a fan of either The Sopranos or Lilyhammer. In any case, he's a man of many hats, and we're going to talk to him on the telephone in a moment. But let's first of all listen to a track from the latest album from Little Stephen and the Disciples of Soul. This is called Soul Fire.
Thank you.
That's Soulfire, Little Stephen and the Disciples of Soul. And it's a great pleasure to welcome to the music show Little Stephen himself, Steve Van Zandt, on the phone from New York City. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hello, my friend. How you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. I read recently that the Beatles turned you into a musician. I found that slightly surprising. I think of you, your sound is so American, so specific, so New Jersey, and the Beatles seemed, well, I was surprised anyway. Can you tell us about your early love of the Beatles?
You know, as a kid, I basically was, buying a few singles, but I didn't have any real interest in doing it, being in show business, so to speak, or being in the music business, until there was a variety show on every Sunday night that the entire family would watch. And in those days, you had one TV in one room. It sounds like the dark ages. But so the variety show would have something on for each age group. They'd have an opera star for the older folks and a puppet show for the kids and something for the teenagers. And something for the teenagers, February 9th, 1964, was a group called the Beatles. And what it did was it blew our minds, my entire generation, because we'd never seen a band before, really. There wasn't any bands before then. There was only single singers or vocal groups, or instrumental groups. It was very, very few bands that played their own instruments and sang. And, of course, the Beatles were just literally like a spaceship landed in your local park. I mean, they were perfect. Their hair was different. Their clothes were different. Their accents, of course, were different. They revealed this other world, which was something that a lot of us needed because, a lot of us were just misfits and outcasts. And so the Beatles revealed the new world, but they weren't exactly inviting because they were too perfect. I mean, we discovered them halfway through their career. They started in 58 and were gone basically by 69. So in 64, they were extraordinarily sophisticated. They were very, very good. The harmony was perfect. The hair was perfect. Everything was perfect. Just 4 months later, the Rolling Stones came. They made it look a lot easier than it was. They were much more accessible. Their clothes were all different from each other. The hair wasn't that perfect, except for Brian Jones. There was no real harmony, to speak of. They were really the first punk band, And more importantly, the most important thing was for me, Mick Jagger did something that I'd never seen anybody do before in show business. He didn't smile. So I was struck by that very much because that meant to me this was not show business for the first time. This is a lifestyle. This is some sort of new kind of thing. And so I very much wanted to be part of that lifestyle, And the bands in general, the Beatles, the Stones, the Yardbirds, the Who, the Kinks, were all communicating something different by being in a band. It was not about me, me, me. It was us. It was the friendship, the family, the posse, the gang, the club. And I wanted very much to be a part of that. So it was the Beatles and the Stones and all of those English groups that turned us on to our own American music. I'd never heard of Muddy Waters. I'd never heard of Chuck Berry. I'd never heard of Bo Diddley. I'd never heard of any of them. And then we started to explore them and explore the soul and R&B and blues roots of all these British guys. And of course, we found out that all of these artists were American. I never heard of Sam Cooke. I never heard of, Arthur Alexander or Larry Williams or any of them.
When you started listening to rock music as a kid, it had no history. It had the antecedents, the people you've just mentioned in passing, the Sam Cookes and so on. But now there's like 60 years of rock history. And I get the impression that's very important. It's very important to you, that history. How do you think it's changed the way that musicians work?
The thing to recognize now that we have 60 years and almost 70 years, really, of history, if we count starting from, around 1951, which is where my radio show goes back to 1951. Mm. What we recognize now is that there was a finite Renaissance period. The fragmentation of the art form really took place in the early 70s. Up until then, it was surprisingly monocultural. You know, everybody tended to go from one trend to the next, and we had that mass shared experience of having one major radio station in every town, basically following those same trends. You went from British Invasion to folk rock to country rock to psychedelic rock, you know, a bit of jazz rock, and then ending up with Southern rock in around 69, which was the final trend of the 60s. And then you're moving into, and then it blew up. The progressive movement started, and the heavy metal started, and singer songwriter started, and all the other stuff. And you would pick up from those trends that which you wanted to add to your identity. Some people would stick with them. Some people would go to blues and stay with blues. Would go to country and stay with country. And some of us just would pick up things here and there, and add them. You know, add them to our. To our quiver, so to speak, and then you become your own hybrid, like we did with Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes in 1974-75. We decided, you know, well, everything's been taken, so we'll combine soul music with rock. You know, we'll have horns, but we'll also have rock guitar. You had to have a strong identity in those days to survive.
Is that the Jersey Shore sound?
Well, it was part of it. I'm not sure you could really generalize about it. I mean, we certainly had the soul and rock roots that I'm talking about. Certainly, me and Bruce had it in common. Southside Johnny had it in common. But then, you know, you also, as part of the Jersey Shore, you also had Bon Jovi. So that was a different thing, you know. So you can't really generalize too much about every single band coming from the Jersey Shore. But I think it has become. More or less known as the Jersey Shore sound, which became the bar band, the sound of a bar band. You know, was different after the Jukes. It was top 40 before the Jukes. After the Jukes, it became soul music oriented. You know, if you go to any bar band now in America, you know, you're going to find a connection to soul music there that didn't exist in the old days. And that caught on very much in that underground cult of bar bands. The Rolling Stone magazine would be reviewing bands and suddenly calling them bar bands, and it used to be an insult, and suddenly it wasn't. You know, they compared them. You know, they compared everybody to the Jukes. They compared Graham Parker and Mink DeVille and Elvis Costello and Huey Lewis and the News. You know, they're all sort of coming out of that suddenly that new bar band tradition.
You're listening to The Music Show on RN, and I'm talking to Little Steve Van Zandt, on today's show. Going back to what you said earlier, Steve, about the collegiality that you recognized in the Beatles, and it was a kind of the group mentality. That's obviously been very important with the Asbury Jukes, with the E Street Band, and also with Disciples of Soul. But maybe we could talk specifically about the E Street Band for a moment. And there's a kind of almost a self-mythologizing quality to some of it. I'm thinking of the song that you did the brass arrangement on, 10th Avenue Freeze Out, which is like a kind of potted history, but also a mythology of the band, isn't it?
Growing up, in those days, you didn't have the information you have now. We kind of bought what publicists were telling us and what we were perceiving. We thought they were all best of friends. We had to find out later till they all pretty much at one point or other all hated each other. You know, Mick and Keith were fighting, and John and Paul were fighting, and the Davis brothers and the Kinks were fighting, and, you know, Townsend and Daltrey were fighting. At some point or other, even though they were all, you know, like brothers, you know, who love each other, occasionally have disputes, we didn't see any of that. So we bought the whole trip, literally. There's a scene in the Beatles' second movie, Help, where the four of them go up to a row of flats, you know, of apartments, and they all have their keys into their own apartment, and they all open the doors of their own apartments, and they step in, and it's one big apartment. That's how we pictured it. You know, we literally pictured these bands living together and being best of friends. We just took it literally, and we were best of friends, you know, to this day, you know, we're best of friends. We didn't know any better, you know, we didn't know there were actually all of these fights going on. It was that collegiality you're talking about, to me, was what it's all about. It's not even the music.
You said that you said you didn't have much interest in showbiz, but I must quickly bring up your acting career, your sort of late acting career, because as Silvio Dante in the Sopranos and as Frank in Lilyhammer, you create such a powerful, glowering presence on the TV screen, and it makes me wonder how much of being a rock star is acting.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. Every singer is an actor. They may not be conscious of it necessarily, but, you know, every song is a script, and it's his job, his or her job, to convince the audience that what he's saying is the truth, you know, is real. In that sense, yes, I think certainly in a singer's case, they are all actors. Yeah, everybody's playing a role, which doesn't make it any less valid or any less real. I believe we all have every characteristic of humankind inside us. I think it's just a matter of what characteristic you want to bring to life. You know, which one do you want to inhabit? The actor's job is to basically find the characteristics that are appropriate for that role in that scene at that moment, and that's the craft. The craft is being able to do that.
Well, we look forward to your visit to Australia with the Disciples of Soul and maybe to Counting the Personalities. Thank you very much indeed, Stephen Van Zandt.
I'm bringing 15 personalities down with me, man.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Come back and say hello, will you?
Okay. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Tenth Avenue Freeze Out, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band with Steve Van Zandt on guitar, and those were his horn arrangements as well from the album Born to Run. And Little Stephen and the Disciples of Soul are touring in April, and they'll be at Blues Fest